This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Meg Eden is here. She's a poet. She's a young adult novelist. And that means she's a young adult who also writes for young adults. And we'll find out all about her. But today, she is a poet. And open it up for us, Meg, with a poem.
Great. I'll start with the poem from my upcoming collection, Drowning in the Floating World. It's called Things to Do in My Hometown, Higashimatsushima, after Gary Snyder. Become a spirit and wander as a lantern through a nostalgic alleyway. Thrift shop in the ruins of a mall. Make miso out of seaweed from a backyard. Make udon from the debris in a living room. Try to remember friends' names and what they looked like before they were found. Watch the water recede. Watch someone at the top of the hill build what looks like a shed for a dog. Imagine living in a dog's house. Imagine being a dog living in a neighbor's house. Make a list of places to move to. Go through the house and find what has and has not been affected. Is the milk still good? The natto? Make a map of where all the buildings used to be. Go to the woods to find something living. Go find a fox. Ask how many tails it takes to outsmart disaster. Tell the fox what it means to be a survivor, and watch the fox tend to its young. Think about what it's like to be the tsunami, filling the earth, subduing it, to be fruitful and multiply, 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 dominion over fish, birds, and over every living thing that moves about the earth.
I'm Grace Cavalieri, and that's Meg Eden. We're at the Library of Congress. Meg, what is the title of that book?
Drowning in the Floating World.
And that has incidents in Japan, right?
Yes.
You were raised in Japan?
No, my father has worked in Japan my whole life, and he's gone very frequently, so it's become a sort of second home.
Because I hear you with the language. Mm. You've got it down. And we'll hear all about that book because that is your most recent book, and that is really the progenitor of something which is very important, which is historical research to write poetry. Mm. Meg Eden, if somebody says, what is your poetry all like? What themes do you have? You know, it's said that we always write the same things over and over and just use different language.
Yes.
And so what are the things that you write over and over?
I think as you say it that way, it makes me realize that there is a common theme. I think we're not always aware that we're writing the same thing over and over again. And so as I was thinking about that question, I was realizing it's memorial. It's the act of remembering, the act of creating a memorial for something that I'm afraid will be forgotten. So I think that started in family history in my hometown, which was middle of nowhere when my father was growing up, and even when I was growing up, and that now that history has kind of been decimated for suburbia. And so there's this urgency of writing that down and putting that on paper to somehow recreate what's kind of been lost.
Making it permanent. Mm. There are worse ways to make a living than to make something last forever. Mm. Meg, what was the little town that nobody knows about?
So it's technically Gambrills, right on the edge of Crofton and Davidsonville.
It still exists.
Yes.
It needs a fresh coat of paint, but it still exists. That's where you're from?
Yes.
Your family?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
But
okay.
When my grandfather bought that property in the 60s, I mean, it was the boondocks. It was middle of nowhere. Everyone made fun of him for buying this old tobacco plant. And that was my father's house. And then I was raised in that house. And just within that time, it was woods, middle of nowhere. And now it's getting crawled on by urban expanse.
For sure. Annapolis is leeching onto it. That is true. Meg Eden, I'm Grace Cavalieri. And I would like to hear a couple more poems. But tell us about how you got to Japan.
How long
were you there? And how many years have you been there?
So, I mean, I've been traveling on and off since late middle school, early high school. And I stayed there for several months in the year 2011, right after the Tohoku earthquake. But I was not in the Tohoku region. I was in Fukuoka.
Well, I'm going to tell them who you are, and then I want to hear a bit more poetry.
Sounds great.
She's been published in many magazines, very prestigious ones, Prairie Schooner, Poetry Northwest, Crab Orchard Review, Rhino, CV2. She teaches creative writing at Anne Arundel Community College and is the author of 5 chapbooks, But I'm very interested in her young adult novel, which was published in 2017. It's Post-High School Reality Quest. Who would not want to read that? She runs the MAGFest
Mages
library blog, which posts accessible academic articles about video games.
Yes.
You go. You are you. Like the whole package. But go back to poetry and we'll get there next.
Sounds
this
good.
Is Meg Eden with poems. Set it up for us, Meg.
Okay, so this poem is called Adam. How quickly the body unfolds like a paper crane, unremembered like a fish in the silent sea of floating fish. Black rain leaves only a sun's shadow memorialized in a wall. A girl remains as only a name in the stomach of a Nagasaki lunchbox. A woman's body wears glass shards like osteoderms, still carrying the child across a carbon black world. The child holds firmly the woman's hand, even when the maggots come, even as she hungers, even when this nuclear rapture has removed her mother, she holds. The second poem is called Okinawa Aquarium, and it's inspired by an exhibit that used to be at Okinawa Aquarium. The most recent time I went there, it was not there anymore, and I'm a little disappointed about that. But the poem will describe what the exhibit was. Framed and mounted on the wall, a dolphin's stomach splayed. Inside, plastic bags, bottle caps, condoms, broken Coke bottles, tampons, lighters, dentures, toys, and bubble wands. If God cut me open with a scalpel, what would he find inside me? My beached body, heavy with human gospel. Removing each piece from me, God would say, I gave you so many trees to eat from. I might say, I felt so full, even briefly, I thought I was really filled.
Meg, I love it.
Thank you.
You're writing about disasters in Japan. They're not all the same disaster, are they? What is the carbon black world you're talking about?
So Adam was inspired by my time going to the Hiroshima Peace Memorial. And so that was from the atomic bomb.
Talk a bit about the Peace Memorial.
So it's a very haunting place. So there's two parts. There's
is it from Nagasaki, Hiroshima?
So I kind of changed the museum I went to was in Hiroshima, and I changed in the poem Nagasaki because there was, of course, still that horror. And so in the museum, what really haunted me were the objects left behind by disaster. And so seeing that lunchbox and thinking there was a girl that owned this lunchbox. And
you see, I'm asking these questions because the young people do not know about it, Meg. They do not know what happened. Mm. So I need you to fill us in because the people hearing this radio, they think Vietnam was like with the dinosaurs. They have no sense of history, no sense of our dropping an atomic bomb on Japan. Mm. So you also talk about the tsunami, right?
Mm-hmm.
And do you talk about various disasters in Japan?
So this is largely focused in 2011. But in the nuclear world section, I start expanding a little bit and bringing connections of thinking of the connection that Japan has historically with nuclear power, that complicated relationship.
I see. Well, let's hear one more and set it up for us so we have it in perspective.
Great. I'll do this poem called Town Hall, which is inspired by, there were photos of one town that was entirely decimated, but this one town hall remained. And there are conversations about maintaining those buildings that did survive as sort of memorials.
From World War II?
So this one is 2011.
Okay.
But there is kind of that link because...
tell us what happened in 2011.
So that was the Tohoku earthquake and Fukushima power plant disaster. And so this unexpectedly large tsunami ravaged coastal towns in the Tohoku region, and it overwhelmed the power plant there. So it was a double whammy of disaster, of not only this decimation through water, but then this fear of... The nuclear power and the poisoning and the radiation and what might come from that. And so this poem is inspired by a building that remained from the tsunami, one of the only ones that still stood, and people are saying we should maintain this building as a memorial to remind people, because it's so easy after disaster to rip everything down, build something new, and completely forget. And so this town hall kind of stands as a memorial. Watching the town resurrect, I remain unfixed, mouth filled with birds. My eyes are dusty and split down the middle, my bowels washed in mud. A car rests in my intestines. The dog in my chest just delivered puppies. I've been given many names, dangerous, abunai, do not enter, haite wa ikemasen. Tsunami, you have erased my neighbors, but I still will remain. I defy you, tsunami. I defy you, town. I will always remember should you mistakenly forget. Here I stand, a new tsunami stone.
I'm just blown away. I am. You were deeply touched by what you saw, right?
Mm.
And you could not live with it until you wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire book is about 2011. What's the title again?
Drowning in the Floating World.
How long did it take you to write that book?
So I think it probably, the seeds were germinated in my trip in 2011, going places where you knew there was devastation, but people were living their lives as if nothing happened. I think that startled me, as well as the fear that people lived with the radiation. People were like, weren't you scared to come here? Wouldn't people let you come here? Aren't you afraid? And so that started in 2011. I think the first time I thought the collection was ready was in 2015. I always preemptively jump the gun and think something's ready, and it's really not. But it did get some semi-finalist awards, and so I continued to kind of work with that material, and this was accepted last year in 2019. So an 8-year journey.
Well, we were talking before this program about how historical research is one approach to poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just quickly, in one sentence, tell us what the process is for historical research? Is it going there? Is it looking at it? Is it going to museums? Is it reading about it? What happened to make this book?
It's everything. I think for me, it was largely research through reading, a lot of reading, a lot of listening. But Japan is such a significant place to me and a place that I'm so familiar with. I think the being in the country is so critical as well. I think I wouldn't feel as intimately connected to the material and to the disaster if Japan wasn't such an important place to me.
And so you feel that the research means hands-on, have to be there.
It means everything. I think you have to have some sort of hands-on connection. Not everyone can always intimately go. I wanted to go see the ruins, and I wanted to see a lot of things more viscerally, and that just couldn't happen. But Japan, I do have visceral connections to that country. And so I think that that was a critical component for me to be able to enter this material at all.
Did you talk to people?
I talked to people when I was there that were in the Tokyo region and the Fukuoka region, and I listened to a lot of interviews from people who were personally affected by the
disaster.
Did
you speak in Japanese?
Very, very little.
Well, you could order lunch, right?
Yes, that's about it.
Meg Eden is here with fabulous work, and we're going to hear some more from her right now.
Great.
We're at the Library of Congress.
So I'll move away from the Tohoku material and read a more recent piece called Phobia as Pantoum.
Tell what a pantoum is.
So pantoum is a Malay form that is was used initially for storytelling, and that still remains in the form. It uses a lot of repetition. It works so well for memory because you loop and you repeat, but you keep moving forward. People talk about it as two steps forward, one step back, as a kind of dance. So with my desire for memorial and dealing with memory, it's a form that I really come back to a lot. So there's no rhyme, actually, in this. It's the second and fourth that are repeated in the next stanza as the first and third lines, and so it's this weaving.
Let's hear it. Meg Eden.
My father's tractor, an 80s blue Ford with shoddy brakes. He didn't tell me. I learned at the top of a hill, feeling it roll towards the road. The brakes gave out. He told me to put it in gear. I was 12 rolling toward the road. The worst feeling, having no control of your own body. Put it in gear. I was 12 and only knew the dial was somewhere between rabbit and tortoise. I had no control of my own body. My father jumped in and turned the wheel. The dial was somewhere between rabbit and tortoise. This is how I thought I would die, when he jumped in and turned the wheel. I let my father push me out of the tractor. This is how I thought I would die when his body hit mine. I let my father push me out of the tractor, and we rolled like stunt doubles. His body hit mine, and the tractor turned over behind us. We rolled like stunt doubles, my penny loafer alone at a distance. The tractor turned over behind us like an animal, wounded. My one foot bare, the other still, and its penny loafer. Oil poured from the tractor's side like an animal, wounded. A week later, my father asks me to mow the lawn. I remember oil pouring from the tractor's side. I tell him I'm not ready. A week later, my father asks me to mow the lawn. You have to get back on the horse, he says. I tell him I'm not ready. I'm afraid of what I can't control. You have to get back on the horse, he says. But I learned at the top of that hill, I'm still afraid of what I can't control. My father's tractor, an 80s blue Ford.
Whatever made you write that 10 years later?
I guess memories come back to you. At certain points you write it and it kind of sits on a shelf and then you explore your shelves again and then you go, oh yeah, and it still resonates with you. And that's when you know it's material that's worth playing with.
It would be nice if for a classroom to pick out the lines they heard repeated. That's so nice. Let's have another poem.
Great. So this one's called Anxiety. Every night Satan sends me a gift basket. It's full of self-pity, depression, and jealousies candied into sucralose. They're so sweet, I can't eat just one. They come wrapped in Instagram photos of all my friends' accomplishments. The card inside says, "Don't you feel like garbage now?" He's also thoughtful enough to include an extensive to-do list with all the deadlines listed as right now. A rainbow bouquet of all my insecurities sits display ready in a crystal vase, so I can look at them all night on my nightstand as I try and fail to fall asleep. Inside, the flowers are rose-colored glasses, so I can look behind me and admire my view of the past. VHS tapes of all my embarrassing failures autoplay in my mind as I touch them. Everything smells like a Yankee candle called What Could Have Been. Some self-absorbed biscuits, 500 calories each, sit at the bottom, and even though I hate their bitter taste and am trying to watch my weight, I eat them all. Satan, ever the thoughtful abuser, never misses a night. Sometimes I wake up from a good night's rest, only to see the remains of last night's gift basket beside my bed. Unwholesome reminder of all my failures. And even if everything is going well as can be, I'll find something wrong in the fullness of that gift basket. Every night, God comes beside my bed holding a trash can. He stands there patiently, waits for me to discard the basket and all its gifts so he can throw it all in the nearest landfill. Sometimes I let him take it away. Sometimes I don't.
Fabulous. That is why I love poets, because they tell the truth. They say things other people just think. So we need you. We need your anxiety. We need your nightmares, sugar-coated as they are. That's terrific. It's terrific. I never thought of turning my anxiety into art, but now I see.
Sometimes that's the only way to cope. That's how I can move forward until it's put on the page. I guess it lays it bare. You have to confront it if it's on the page.
Then put it in a drawer.
Yes.
Exactly. Meg, you are a novelist.
Yes.
And your novel was quite successful. What was it about? And what made you write a young adult novel?
So Post-High School Reality Quest is about a girl who thinks she's stuck in a video game. And you're trying to figure out if she's really in the game or if it's all in her head.
Oh, my gosh. This must be a bestseller.
Oh, no.
But it's perfect for today. But you know video games,
yes.
And really?
Yes.
How decadent of you. For a poet, you know video games? You game?
Yes.
Well, I am just unbelieving. You're the first poet in the history of this program that is a gamer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but of course it's your age, too, your generation. So what happened to this girl? Did she get out of the video game?
So I don't want to spoil it. I wanted to leave the opening intentionally ambiguous so that you have to kind of wrestle with figuring out what truly happened.
Do you use a game in the novel?
So it's more that her life is a game. So if, you know, she'll die and respawn, when and she'll try things again. If she regrets a decision, she'll go back and do it again.
Meg, what is the title? We want everyone in the world to get this book.
It's Post-High School Reality Quest.
Well, I think it's a terrific idea. Has anyone written anything like it?
It is one of a kind. The way it's narrated, it's in the second person, which all your creative writing teachers will say you should never do. So I defied them. And it was very fun.
And just a little bit more about it, so I promise we'll buy it. Just what do you love the most about the book?
I love, I think what you were saying about with the anxiety of having to put things on the page, I think this was one of the first ways I tried to grapple with that, because in games you can restart everything. You play and you regret, and so you can go back to a save file and get it perfect. In life, you can't do that, and so I was just like, what if a character could do that? And it's so cathartic thinking, what if you regret a decision and you could go back and try it again? But sort of the novel kind of shows that even with that, you never feel full satisfaction, even if you think you will.
So you are technically excellent. Are you excellent technically?
In what?
But with technology.
I don't know if I'd say
Aren't video games very challenging?
Depends on the game. There's quite a range.
I see. Well, you have a facet I really hadn't known. I thought you were just a nice, wholesome girl. Poet. Let's have another.
Great. So this one is called Ode to My Neck Fat.
Say that again.
Ode to My Neck Fat.
I didn't know if I heard that right.
Yeah, I gained a lot of weight at a stressful job, and then I wrote about the neck fat that was the result from that.
Makes for art.
It's a good way to cope. Oh, tea-stained teeth and Kmart bangs, girlish scrunchies, rosacea purple skin. All of these a crown for you, my turkey gizzard, double chin, eternal flesh necklace. In the mirror, you make me into an aged nightmare of myself, caricature cat lady, pampered chef party host. No gym nor diet will tame you. You stand your ground. Slick like a salesman, you are real enough to grab but never fully hold. My hate for turtlenecks keeps you bare and proud. Every night I pluck your hairs, compulsive, afraid for you, because as much as I hate you, you are all I have that stays familiar, my only chapel in this revolving door of a body.
You're going to give Neck Fat a good name. We're all going to want it. It's going to be so trendy. And what's your next poem?
So this one's a very fresh one. Somewhere Midwest on the way home from AWP.
Which you have to explain.
The Association of Writers and Writing Conferences program. The server at IHOP pours our water, not from a pitcher, but a paper cup. She says, "That leaves some for me then." Laughs. It sounds like something my grandmother might say. She's old enough to be my grandmother, to have dementia like my grandmother. Where did she get that paper cup and that water for the paper cup? I try to not think too hard and focus on my pancakes. She comes back and looks at E's plate. "Is this fully cooked?" she asks. Let's hope so. I don't trust this waitress, but in a sad sort of way. It's the same feeling I feel every time my grandmother offers me something when I come over. I remember she used to make the best chicken nuggets. How long ago was that? The waitress pokes at E's leftover food, complains about the waste. In the back room, will she put it all in a box and bring it home? Or sit right there in her uniform, eating E's leftovers? I wouldn't blame her. I grew up in the 90s, but still live like every day's the Great Depression. I don't know why this woman still works here, why no one takes away her paper cup, which I later saw her drink from. Maybe she can't afford to retire. Maybe she's worked here for the past 40 years. Maybe no one has the heart to fire her. Or maybe this is the first of many days to come that she's acted off. Maybe. My grandmother always says in restaurants, my mother was a waitress. As we eat, she gives the same story. She raised all us kids while waiting tables. She worked so hard for us, all on her own. That's why I always give good tips, because of my mother. She loops my mother, as if to say, as if even her dementia knows to say, this is important. Write this down.
That is a perfect demonstration of what a poet is. You don't miss a trick. Everything matters. Mm. The cup the waitress holds. What's in the cup? Why is she there? That is really, people don't understand. The poet is the chronicler of the immediate history at the moment, what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And these precious things, these moments that you capture are more than money can buy. That's why there is no money in poetry. It's just too good for money. It's just too good for money.
Yes.
It's preserving the present. Mm. So good. We're so happy you're here, May. Give us a final poem.
Okay. This is called Alzheimer's, Where My Grandmother is a Blueberry Bush. Mm. And the reason for this is because I live in my father's childhood home, and we have this incredible blueberry bush, this half the size of this room, perhaps. And my grandmother planted that in the 60s. Tiny thing, and it has just grown and grown, and it's such a critical part of our summers, picking those blueberries off that bush. And I just always think of my grandmother. It's a way that she remains in that house, even though she no longer lives there. A mimosa grows out of my grandmother. Every spring I weed her. I climb inside her chest and cut the poison ivy, honeysuckle, grapevines that try to grow around her arms. Every year it thickens. Every year I have less time to tend to her. I go to school. I am getting married. My grandmother understands. Her berries get fewer. The ones that fill get snatched by birds. A cat lives inside my grandmother's feet and has given birth to kittens. I am moving out soon. Who will take care of my grandmother? Every time I visit, she becomes less and less recognizable. My grandmother is buried alive in a dress of underbrush. My parents can't maintain her. It's getting harder to discern what is grandmother, what is weed, what is aging.
The voice of Meg Eden. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.